You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. If someone calls you an amateur, it's usually not a compliment, but my guest today reminds us in many ways it is, even despite the speaker's intention. Jack Hitt says America has historically been and remains a country of amateurs. They're the people who drive the success of our country and the identity of its people. Think Ben Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, Thomas Edison, Steve Jobs, or today people like Malcolm Gladwell, Michael Pollan, or the whole do-it-yourself movement. Jack Hitt is the author of Bunch of Amateurs, A Search for the American Character. To him, the amateur's dream is the American dream. Amateurs have a sense of possibility, pretend and play, because there's no money, no power, no prestige in what they're doing. They simply want to know. They have a different relationship to failure. It's just a glitch. Amateurs question traditional methods, which often lead to innovation. Jack Hitt is a contributing editor to the New York Times Magazine, Harper's, as well as public radio's This American Life. You can hear him there, as well as stories from The Moth. He also writes for Rolling Stone, GQ, and Wired. He's also the author of a solo theater performance titled Making Up the Truth. The name of the book, Bunch of Amateurs, and he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Jack Hitt, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, Rich. Thanks for having me.
This book, A Bunch of Amateurs, you know, we just think of, you've actually talked quite a bit about the word amateur because it's had different definitions. And today, if you're called an amateur, that's pretty much a pejorative, isn't it?
Well, you know, it depends on the context, right? I mean, amateur athletes, we think of them as good, maybe not the best, right?
And idealistic, too. Somewhat idealistic.
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, you're right, the word has contradictions to it. I mean, if I called somebody a rank amateur, clearly an insult. But if I said, look, I have a friend, he's an amateur art collector, you'd think, oh, so he's pretty good at it then.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, bunch of amateurs is just kind of a cheerful term. but, you know, if you look it up in the dictionary, if you look it up in the Roget's Thesaurus, you'll see that it just has this collection of meanings that you know, everything from like a dilettante, like a pretentious twit, to a novice, a greenhorn, somebody who doesn't know what he's doing, to somebody who kind of does know what he's doing. And I think that contradiction, actually, that whole set of opposing meanings, is very much a kind of American situation, because my argument in the book is that we were condemned as sort of amateurs from the very beginning.
Yes, indeed. I want to go back, though, to an earlier age when amateur was, there was no pejorative to it at all. Amateur athletics around the late 1800s,
sure.
That was basically people with money who didn't have to be into the tawdry world of professionalism. When you go back even further, an amateur was a man of means who might be making discoveries in science, in literature, in anything.
Right. I mean, you go back to, say, someone like Jefferson in the 18th century. I mean, this is a guy who collected woolly mammoth bones and had interest in the frontier and the origins of Native American Indians. I mean, his interests were, and anyone who's visited Monticello knows that he invented the auto pen, you know, the little machine that you can sign two documents with at the same time. And all of those guys in that era were tinkerers in that sense. I mean, everybody felt like an amateur. It's really in the 19th century we start creating sort of more professionalized places like universities that grant credentials, and organizations like the American Medical Association and tons of professional organizations that grew out of that whole 19th century movement of creating these kind of professional outfits that would grant you the credential that would make you a professional version of whatever that was, doctor, you know, lawyer, you know, carpenter even. I mean, every group now has its own trade association, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you're right. In an earlier age, sort of everybody was an amateur because everybody kind of fiddled around in everything. And that's sort of what leads to this kind of mistake that I talk about in the book, which is that we're always convincing ourselves that the age of amateurism was just past. It was like our grandfather's time, you know? And here's the deal with that. We've been saying that for about 150 years. And invariably what happens is that the cycle sort of comes back around in some way. For instance, if you go back to Stephen Jobs, right, the guy who invented the desktop computer in a garage in Cupertino, and we love telling that story. But I think one of the things that we forget about that story is that a great deal of computer technology was simply inaccessible, professionalized, right, run by universities. The computers were giant machines, and motherboards were these monstrous vacuum tube run you know, devices. And then what happened is, you know, a little bit of a technological breakthrough, and all of a sudden you know, these parts are available at, you know, the equivalent of Radio Shack.
Yeah.
And now they become toys for teenagers to tinker with, which is exactly what happened with Jobs and Wozniak. And you see that happen time and time again throughout our history, that just when we think everything's gotten so specialized and so professionalized that nobody except for the big companies and the big players can possibly get anything done, lo and behold, here comes some kid or some crazy guy in a garage who took this formerly inaccessible technology, kind of played with it a little bit, and created something completely brand new.
We also shouldn't forget Bill Gates in that, too. Again, somebody who came at it from amateur status, not credentialed to a university, to create his company.
Right. I mean, if you look at Gates or Paul Allen, his partner back then, they're all, you know, Wozniak and Jobs, all college dropouts. Mark Zuckerberg, who's very recent, also a college dropout. I mean, for these kids especially, you know, the discovery of something and the timeliness of it, you know, this revelation of, like, either I jump on Facebook now and turn it into a billion-member club, or somebody else will do it. And so, you know, the dropout just becomes seized by, you know, this idea, this one idea, and steps out with it. But, yeah, the list is immense.
Well, I would think as you got into this, you found that this is perhaps maybe even a golden age of amateurism. When you think of, you know, technology has allowed a lot of things that, for example, film. Film was something you had to have a whole bunch of money. You had to have a studio backing you to make a film. Now with technology, you can make your own film for a dime, you know. Music, you used to have to go into a recording studio, have a major label. Now anybody who, you know, has a great song can record it and put it out there. It's really a democratization, and it sort of amateurizes a lot of fields that used to be, quote, professional.
Oh, that's absolutely right. I mean, you can almost look at any modern discipline right now, and the means of distribution were once complicated technologies that were in the hands of a handful of players. Like you say, pressing a vinyl record album 20 years ago was a very expensive, complicated business. Now creating a very good sound digital file off your computer, not so difficult. Journalism, I mean, look at what I do. Print journalism has been absolutely upended and totally reinvented by bloggers. And, you know, when it all first happened, you know, there were tons of these, like, idiotic conferences, like, blogging, is it real? Is it really journalism? And really what you were watching were the professional class of journalists fretting terribly, as they should, that a bunch of punks and cubs were coming up to take away their high-paying jobs, which is, in fact, what has happened. But that's the natural process of, if you want a good metaphor, you know, it's like, you know, a fortress of expertise gets built up over time in any profession. And typically, the outsiders, however they're defined, amateurs, you know, naives, whatever, often wrong, but sometimes right, come and attack that fortress and often bring it down. In fact, one of the chapters in my book is about that very process, how that happens, how the fortress got built and then how it got, you know, basically razed by a crowd of amateur banshees.
Well, you use a story of this conflict between professionals and amateurs going back to the creation of the Republic, and that is the different approaches of John Adams and Ben Franklin towards cultivating the French in the American Revolution. You say this is a classic case of professional versus amateur.
Yeah. They were both sent to France in 1778 to see if we could convince the king to give us money. I remember how difficult this would be, right? We're asking a king to give us money to overthrow a king. Not exactly an easy diplomatic chore. So we sent Franklin because he was the greatest man of his day. He had, you know, invented, he had discovered electricity. He was much older than the other founding fathers. He was in his, you know, 70s when we sent him over there. And Adams was a kid, you know, like, you know, late 20s, early 30s. And it's good to remember that, by the way. Franklin is 50 years older than most of the founding fathers. We all lump them together, but Franklin's a very different character, right? It would be like all of us getting together and deciding, you know, 20 years ago that we wanted to do something really important and then suddenly having Albert Einstein with us, you
right.
know? Like, okay, what do we do with this guy? And what Washington and those guys did was they sent Franklin to Paris thinking he'll impress everybody and get us the money. Well, he gets over there. And, you know, he realizes that the French really do see us as these kind of like unfinished people, these amateur, these frontiersmen, people born out of the soil practically, filthy, wearing, you know, fur skins and coonskin caps and these shredded boots and all this stuff. That was sort of the propaganda of the day. And in fact, Franklin had one of these coonskin caps, and when he got off the boat, he had it on just because he was an old bald guy and wanted to keep his head warm. and somebody saw it, and he realized right away that it really worked for him to have this outfit on. So he totally swanned about Paris for a while wearing this ridiculous frontier outfit. Now, remember, Franklin was probably the only sophisticate we had at the time.
And he's really basically going to play up the rube in many ways.
Right, exactly. He sort of became the first modern celebrity. People painted him. There were little snuff tins. You can still buy them at Sotheby's in auction. Now they cost thousands of dollars. With Franklin's face on them, often with the coonskin cap on. Paris loved this image. They loved this idea. And remember, this is the first time the world was looking at us as new people. You know, before that, when Ben had traveled to Paris, he was just another British colonial. But now, everybody in the world looked at us differently. Oh, you're Americans. What does that mean? And so Franklin realized that there were a lot of presumptions about what it was to be an American. And he totally played that up. So he's running around town in costume. Then, lo and behold, up shows up John Adams, who's very proper. And he goes to meet the king. And he has on a, you know, in those days, there were actually shops right near Versailles where you could rent the official garb for visiting the king. You know, the way, like, prom dates go and get a nice tuxedo. You could rent, like, a sword and, you know, the frilly, you know, lace cuffs and the white waistcoats and the proper boots and, you know, breeches and all that stuff. And so we know that, you know, Adams had that outfit on when he met Franklin at the gates of Versailles for the first time. And I love to think of Franklin stepping out of that carriage in his coonskin cap and John Adams going, "Oh, my God, what are you doing?" You
know? And that sort of defines a relationship between professionals and amateurs, doesn't it?
Right. And see, I mean, a key feature of the amateur is this idea of improvisation, right? Of this idea of, like, not playing by the official expert rules, which Adams was always up to, but just sort of, like, fiddling around and trying to figure, like, what's going to work now? And that's really what Franklin was doing. He was like, okay, so I think this garb, this whole attitude that I'm going to adopt here is going to, like, work for us. And, of course, it did.
My guest today is Jack Hitt, a contributing editor at the New York Times Magazine, Harper's, and Public Radio's This American Life. His new book is titled A Bunch of Amateurs, A Search for the American Character, and it's published by Crown, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you tell us this story. You have these great illustrations of this conflict between professionals and amateurs. The first is up in Connecticut, I guess your neck of the woods, this idea that perhaps there was an Irish colony of some sort in Connecticut in maybe the 5th or 6th century A.D., is that right?
Yes. Not far up the road from me is this strange ancient site. It has about 10 of these stone-built beehive shelters. You know, they look like they might be little potato cellars or something. Or, I mean, you know, I'm 6'2". You can stand up in one and just, you know, sort of barely hunch over in the center, right? It's a kind of, like I said, it's a little beehive-shaped thing.
And the professionals would say they're root cellars.
And root cellars, yes. I mean, yeah. They've been described as pigsties, root cellars, you know, potato bins. But they were there, you know, when Native Americans lived in this area. And they were the ones who gave it this funny name, Gungeewomp. No one quite knows where that word comes from. Anyway, there's a collection of sort of amateur archaeologists and anthropologists who've sort of formed around there, formed little clubs called the Gungeewomp Society. And they believe that these stone shelters are evidence of a Celtic voyage across the Atlantic about 1,500 years ago. And, of course, most of the mainstream archaeologists and officials think this is probably not likely, if not foolish. And I went and visited with them, and, I like these kinds of characters, so I, you know, was hanging out with them. But then I started reading up on all of this and other theories like it, and I was kind of thrilled to discover that the finding of Viking artifacts in Newfoundland and Canada, you probably know about this, right, mm-hmm. Was carried out by this sort of amateur archaeologist from Norway named Helge Ingstad. He was just obsessed with the idea that Vikings actually did go over there. And this was a completely renegade theory back in the 50s. And then in early 60s, he and some others found these actual Viking artifacts in Newfoundland, and it completely changed the whole dating of the arrival of Europeans to the North American shores. Well, these guys are saying, like, well, we think some Irish people came over here 500 years before the Vikings. And the thing is, it's no longer considered crazy to say this. There is, in fact, an epic poem in Ireland called The Voyage of St. Brendan the Monk. It does recount this voyage in these tar pitch canoes across a very cold and long sea to a new land. it may be that they came here. We don't have good proof of it, but in my book, what I just try to argue is that, sure, it's fun to perhaps laugh at these people because it's always fun to be on the side of the experts, you know, sort of looking down your nose at these frivolous amateur fools with their crazy theories. But sometimes those amateur fools are right. Helga Engstad showed us that.
Your tone went from curiosity to skepticism immediately. And then once you actually visited one of these sites and went way back into one of these rooms that you said, you know, who would make a pigsty or a potato bin like this? And well, so yeah, it went so from skepticism to, you know, well, maybe they've got something here.
Right. I mean, if you go in one of these, in the main one, the biggest one, you go in, you can, like I say, you can sort of stand up in the center. It's about 6 feet or so tall. But then there's a little side place. You have to get on your hands and knees and crawl through a small little tunnel of stone. And then there's another one right next to it, hidden. It's underneath the dirt. It's not, you don't, from outside this stone structure, you wouldn't see this one because it's in the dirt mound behind it. And so it's like a hideout. Mm-hmm. And I'm in there. I climb, the guy shows me this. I go in there and I'm thinking, well, why would anyone who's building a root cellar have a crawl space where you could go hide out? Well, apparently in Ireland, where they do build these kinds of root cellars, they often did have these little hideout areas because, of course, in that age, the Irish coast was being ravaged by Vikings who would come and, you know, kill the men and take away the women.
Steal all the food.
Right, and steal all the food and burn your manuscripts. But that was, you know, standard operating procedure Viking-wise in 600 A.D. And so it is peculiar, let's just say, that a structure that looks a lot like a Celtic structure from that age is sitting in eastern Connecticut.
Well, from that, where you have the professionals basically poo-pooing what the amateurs are championing, you go to the next story of the ivory-billed woodpecker, which is, you know, it's kind of crazy that the professionals jumped on the idea that this bird that hadn't been seen for 60 years all of a sudden is existing down in the swamplands of eastern Arkansas. And all of a sudden, it's the amateurs who begin questioning the professionals. We always think of it as usually amateurs coming up with a theory that the professionals poke holes into it. It actually works the other way around as well.
It does work the other way around. And that whole I was sort of covering that from the very beginning, and it was just amazing to watch this a new truth sort of stand up in America, that the ivory-billed woodpecker existed. Now, for those of you who don't know much about birding, it's important to understand that the ivory-billed woodpecker is, without question, the most sought-after missing bird for half a century. It was last seen officially around World War II, but there have been rumors that it still exists. It's a big bird. It's a very lively, gregarious bird. There's pictures of these old-timers in the 40s standing out in the woods with an ivory-billed woodpecker standing on their head. You know, it's a very friendly, funny bird. I mean, between that and the pileated, it was sort of the basis for Woody Woodpecker, right? Mm-hmm. The loud, talkative, you know, loquacious kind of hang out with humans sort of thing. But then it seemed to disappear after World War II. And there were various sightings here and there. And then suddenly in 2005, the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, the very definition of a fortress of expertise, got wind of a sighting in Arkansas and went and launched a secret mission that lasted more than a year, where they put all these ornithologists on the ground and put recording devices in the swamp and, you know, marked out these grids and walked through them and looked for evidence of scalings the way, you know, ivory bills would mark the trees. And they found all this. They found everything. They even had a small video of the bird. It was a bit blurry because the camera was out of focus, but there it was on a tree in the distance. They'd analyzed it frame by frame and used their great PhD expertise to show that the bird existed. And this was greeted in the country at the time. I'm sure many of your listeners will remember this, but it was almost as if Noah's dove had returned to the ark. I mean, it was announced in Washington, D.C. amid a pageant of flags and the Department of the Interior. President Bush was, you know, and his administration were proud to announce that they would authorize $20 million to restore the habitat of the sacred ivory-billed woodpecker. So this was all seen as a beautiful and glorious environmental story, almost, like I say, like Noah's Ark, a sense of forgiveness, like maybe we hadn't been so bad after all. you know, maybe the environment is not as damaged as we thought it was.
Because, I think that's one of the reasons they played it up, too.
Yeah. Right, totally, yeah, because it was such good news, and everybody was exultant about it, right? And then there were just a couple of questions started to pop up here and there. You know, and then, by the way, this was done. You know, it was finished. It was like, ivory-billed woodpecker exists. Here's $20 million. We're going to go restore the habitat. Here it is. It's great. People can come in there and take pictures. It's going to be awesome. And then, lo and behold, the real first crack in all of this was David Sibley, who is a painter of birds. He's not a professional ornithologist by any description, but he is a very well-known observer of birds. And he looked at the video and he said, you know, I'm just not sure y'all got that right. I think if you look at it this way, and he went into very specific detail about feather color and the tilt of the wing, you know, it's an amazing analysis. And he said, I think what you have here is a common pileated woodpecker, which are very common, especially in Arkansas, and you just looked at it wrong. Well, that set everybody's teeth on edge. And then what happened was a blogger named Tom Nilsson, who's just an amateur birder, started writing about this, and then lots of people started contributing to his site. And for about 3 years, the amateurs just poured into this one website and really just slowly deconstructed everything Cornell had said. What about the recorded sounds? What about the scalings? What about the professional observations? You know, 7 of these professional ornithologists claim to have seen with their own eyes an actual ivory-billed woodpecker. Well, their sightings, which were all written down with, you know, detailed notes, the amateurs went over each one of those and slowly revealed that each one of those was a mistake. Hmm. And they completely demolished. And I mean, it's now almost universally accepted that no one saw an ivory-billed woodpecker in 2005 and that Cornell made maybe one of the greatest mistakes ever. The only place you don't hear that is Cornell. But what's amazing, the story is just to see how a truth gets constructed in our country and then how it gets deconstructed. In this case, it was just a kind of a nice, almost parable of how we can get something wrong and then how, with this kind of slow crowdsourcing amateur, you know, analysis, we can actually get it right.
My guest today is Jack Hitt. His new book is titled Bunch of Amateurs, A Search for the American Character, published by Crown. And getting back to that question of whether the golden age of amateurs is over or is it just getting started, I look at all the different fields where amateurs are leading the way. Or, you know, you look at a field like astronomy. Astronomy depends on amateurs for discovering asteroids coming nearby Earth. You look at robotics, amateurs all over this field. You look at television reality shows, amateurs all over our television these days. Amateurs are everywhere.
Yeah, there's so much to say about that. I mean, the nice thing about, you mentioned astronomy, I mean, they've always been sort of the backbone of professional astronomy, and that's one where you really see how the two can actually work together in a good way. Because amateurism sort of left alone, left uncommunicated with in your garage, you know, you sort of end up in the mad world of trying to find perpetual motion or, you know, limitless
cold
energy.
Fusion.
Or, right, cold fusion. I mean, and so we know where that goes, right? I mean, and so it's important you have, you know, either, like you say, a robotics club, right, where you meet every month and reconnect to other people doing this and probably some professionals who are there to sort of knit your own observations and thoughts and theories into something that's very real. Otherwise, you do end up, you know, sort of the classic amateur lunatic who's, you know, convinced that GM has stolen your, you know, 300-mile-per-gallon secret fuel or whatever. we know that those characters. But, yeah, the pro-am sort of, you know, collaboration is really you really see it in astronomy. I'll give you one, like, fabulous example. A couple of years ago, NASA, the Hubble telescope, downloaded 1 million pictures of different galaxies that they wanted to categorize, you know, spiral, elliptical, and that kind of thing. And, you know, 1 million pictures. I mean, how long would that take? I mean, a professional astronomy department, it would take a decade or so, you know. So they actually put the whole database of these pictures up on the web, invited amateurs to come in, take a sort of a little quick lesson on how to do this, and then and run through these things. And, you know, within a year, it was all done. That's called Galaxy Zoo. And it's since that model has now just become commonplace in so many things, where we just, instead of having 10 people do a job, why not have 100,000 people do it very part-time? and just get it done almost overnight. So you see those kinds of, you know, collaborations happening all the time on the internet. But here's the other thing that I think is important to say about right now. You're talking about, are we in an amateur revival right now? I don't think it's a coincidence that a bad economy sort of inaugurates a kind of amateur cycle. Let's don't forget, Jobs and Wozniak went into that Cupertino garage in 1976 at the height of the sort of Gerald Ford whip inflation now sort of doldrums, right? And David Packard and William Hewlett, they went into a Palo Alto garage in 1938, the height of the Depression, and invented their company. And in fact, by the way, that garage that Packard and Hewlett went into in 1938 is, you know, right before he died, Packard remodeled the entire thing. It's now a registered historic landmark in Palo Alto. because that's really like one of our sacred temples of ingenuity, right? I mean, the garage is a kind of, it's almost a cliche, but for good reason, right? That's where people go to sort of escape the bills and the demands of the domestic sphere of the house, right? You slip out back, and then you're in that sort of playful space where the mind can kind of relax and find new things. So it's not a coincidence that Packard was in a garage, you know, that that Wozniak and Jobs were in a garage, that Zuckerberg was in a dorm room, because these are places where the mind is sort of like at ease, right?
And when times are bad, you have plenty of time on your hands to think and tinker.
Exactly. I mean, I think it's what happens when the economy goes south is people lose their jobs, they become frustrated, or they think, hey, you know, that thing I always wanted to do, I'm going to do that now because I got nothing else I have to do. And so, you know, just a few weeks ago, there was a big article in the New York Times about these DIY do-it-yourself labs that are opening up in various cities. One just opened up in New York.
One just opened up in Tulsa called the Fab Lab. It's a computerized fabrication laboratory, yeah, that anybody
exactly.
can go in and build things in there. Yeah.
Right, and you pay like a small fee, and then you have access to a lab. And I live in this, you know, Tulsa's a huge town. I live in New Haven, Connecticut. It's a very small town, and we have one. We have this called Maker Haven, and that's the same kind of thing. It's like a little place where you can pay a fee and go in there and, you know, and tinker around to your heart's content. And again, you know, the nice thing about Fab Lab and Maker Haven is that, you know, these are places where you can go and meet other people and sort of like, you know, run your ideas past other folks who will tell you, no, you're going insane. There is no perpetual energy, perpetual motion. You know, bring it back. Come back this side of the line there, Rich, and maybe you'll have a good invention, right? So, I mean, that sense of semi-collaboration is people who've studied this and managerial experts who've tried to bottle the kind of amateur spirit and try to teach it to corporations, because trust me, they're spending millions trying to figure out like how the kind of playful spirit that happens in a garage or a fab lab can be translated to an actual business. It's not easy, because you know, if you're being paid, then you're not an amateur. I mean, the very definition of an amateur is someone who's not paid. I mean, if your motivation is to make money, then you have a very specific kind of desire, right? I mean, your desire to get ahead and be promoted in your company and so forth, it becomes very sort of tunnel vision. Whereas the sort of open-endedness of the amateur idea is what often gives it its kind of creative edge.
The name of the book is Bunch of Amateurs, A Search for the American Character. Jack Hitt, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Rich. That was great.
Jack Hitt speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His book is titled Bunch of Amateurs, A Search for the American Character. It's published by Crown. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.